You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 319, television commercials through the ages. Can we avoid mentioning Don Draper? I hope not. Our legendary Premiership football predictions. How badly will we get it wrong this season? And time passages. How some people younger than us are always older than us. Huh? It's all come right up after the slits, and I heard it through the grapevine.
So many things to adore on that track. The outstanding drumming skills of Budgie, the magnificent production by Dennis Bovell, the inspired vocal of Ariane, the B-side of their first single from 1979, The Slits, and I Heard It Through the Grapevine. It meandered its way to number 60 in the UK charts. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 319, no less. I'm Terence Stackham, and speaking of inspired vocal skills, it's Julia Harris.
Too kind. Hello, good evening, good afternoon, good morning, good night, depending on where you are and when you're listening.
Jules, each August in the quiet so-called silly season. The
public, it's nice to have one this year, actually. It feels more refreshing than ever because everything's been so big for so long, and there was no silly season last summer because of that thing that happened.
Yes, indeed. I'm still waiting for the newspaper, always the first report. Is there a lynx or a lion loose on Exmoor or in an Essex village? That's when you know that the silly season is really bedded in.
The big cat stories. I was listening to the excellent podcast, fortunately, with Fee Glover and Jane Garvey recently, and they talked to, I think it was Fee Glover, said that she'd been on Somerset Sound or something when she was, that was one of her first kind of postings from the Beeb, and she said that they used to wait for the big cat stories to start in the summer, and they when asked as to why, she speculated it was sort of pubs open for longer, I think was the general, you know, it's like pubs are open for longer. That was the general kind of consensus behind what drove the big cat stories.
At this time of year, the public relations teams from TV companies like to make grandiose announcements of what's to come in the autumn or fall, if you're in America, the fall season. I don't think I've ever been less impressed with such ballyhoo as this week's PR releases for upcoming TV shows. It's more cookery, more dancing and singing shows, and most bizarre of all, the news this week that ITV are shooting yet another version of Pride and Prejudice.
I know, what is the point?
It makes me wonder if TV companies, you know, they only have access to one book.
Yes, pass it around. In the commissioner's office. And the funny thing is, it's Nina Raine that's doing this adaptation that's behind it. Nina Raine has written a number of, a friend of mine on Twitter made this point the other day, that Nina's actually, written a number of good books, and that she's an English theatre director and kind of playwright person, and you know, there is so much good original material that she has written. Can't they adapt some of her stuff? Why does it always have to be Pride and Prejudice?
It's extraordinary. I can only think it's for reasons of economy, that so much of Pride and Prejudice takes place in a very limited location, most of it in sort of ballrooms and drawing rooms.
Well,
and
yes,
so on,
quite. It's, and you can recreate that.
Yeah.
You know, all you need to do is hire a big house or get some MDF if it's ITV's sneer. So I don't know. But I agree with you, it is a bit kind of, you know, so what really. And my mum said the other day, I hate summer, there's no dramas. And it's true, there are no, you know, they stockpile everything for the winter, don't they?
Oh, they do, yeah.
To me, if Line of Duty is not on TV, then there is little that I watch, really. Obviously, you know, the whole world stops for Only Connect, but that aside, there's little, and even the stuff that I like, you know, stuff like Lucy Worsley's documentaries, which of course, as anyone that goes anywhere near my Twitter feed knows, I am a huge fan, but even that's a bit kind of, you know, is she doing the Tudors again? You know, that seems
Hampton Court all over again.
Yeah, well, to be fair, always Hampton Court there. Yes, but it's a bit kind of, I don't know. She's, whatever she does is really interesting, but everything seems formulaic. And BBC Four, you think, oh, good, it's another Friday night of documentaries about Pink Floyd, and you know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of invention at the moment. Maybe because there's not a lot of money, I don't know, but. I'm not sure. I don't know what it is that I want to watch on telly, but I'm not seeing it.
I certainly feel I know more about Anne Boleyn than the people who were in the court of Henry Tudor at the time.
Absolutely.
I know her intimately.
Ridiculous. I was talking to a friend of mine once when we were at university. This was kind of in a days of a different curriculum, I suppose, about 20 years ago. There used to be far more localised teaching. We were reminiscing about this, that there was more regional variations in curriculum. And we all used to talk proudly and sort of sarcastically about where we came from and the fact that we were constantly battered over the head with our own local history. So, of course, I am almost expert level on the Battle of Hastings because I am from Hastings, and you know, I have run cross country around the site, you know, I know everything there is. Well, I feel sometimes like I do know a lot about it. And my friend from Stoke said that, you know, if she saw another archaeological pot, she might scream. So she's very good on ceramics. There was someone else from just outside of where the Battle of the Boyne was that knew that extremely well as well. So there used to be a lot more kind of localized sort of thing. So yes, it was always, we used to say the two seasons of school were the Tudors and Battle of Hastings. That mm-hmm. was our seasons. And actually, just before we move on, that this is so off topic at the moment, but the two seasons thing, I was reading rereading one of Claire Balding's books recently, my Animals and Other Family, I think it's called. It's fantastic. If you haven't read it, it's a really good read. And she, of course, coming from a family that is obsessed with horse racing, her brother Andrew goes to school and the teacher asks the class, what name the seasons of the year? And he puts his hand up and says, Flat and National Hunt.
Excellent. Absolutely excellent. One aspect of television you can't avoid at all in America and over here, if you watch the channels other than the BBC, is the commercials, the adverts. Now, in the early years, the Don Draper era, if you like, TV ads were simplistic and generally relied on a jingle or the endorsement of a famous figure to gain our attention. But then, Jules, well, you've a theory as to the pivotal point when TV ads went from annoying interruptions to moments that actually viewers actually look forward to.
Well, yes, I think there are two major brands that managed to do this. I'll talk briefly about the first one and then I'll talk about my favourite. And I think this particularly reached a peak in the late 80s and then the 90s. It says a lot that if you Google Guinness ads, one of the first things that pops up is top five best Guinness ads on YouTube. The fact that there is a subgenre of Guinness ads suggests to me that it is successful. And there have been some fantastic adverts that they produced in the 90s. There was one called Surfer. I mean, this is the days when adverts had names, you know, when the glory days of the 90s where people had money to wang at advertising agencies. And Surfer involved... You'd think, oh, it just involves someone running amongst some black and white horses on a beach in monochrome. but yeah, it was set to Fat Planet by Left Field and had a very portentous voiceover. And they did an advert with some racing snails and they just looked wonderful. And of course, the thing that made them so good was they were based around the central concept of Guinness, which is black and white. Oh, of course. So all of their adverts were monochrome. So actually... It was perfect. It was an excellent trick. It wasn't like one of those things where, you know, there's a woman with a negligee on and they're standing on the top of a building and it's all very intense. And you know what's going on. Then it turns out they're flogging perfume. There really was a general kind of, you know, there was a general kind of center point to it. And another brand that were very similar that I think really changed advertising, Levi's adverts.
Oh, yes.
So starting with Nick came, your man Nick Kamen taking his clothes off in the 80s. It did just go to show nothing ever changes. He had a brief abortive pop career off the back of that. Yeah. But they kind of, the thing about Levi's was, of course, again, it was always based around the product, which was jeans. So of course, him taking his clothes off in the laundrette, you think of the jeans. But so many Levi's adverts growing up in the 90s. I remember them for the music. A bit like Apple were to a lesser degree in the 2000s. If you got your record on a Levi's advert, you could have a hit in a cool way. Nowadays, the shame of kind of, there is no shame to frogging your record as to someone to flog stuff. You know, in the olden days, it was really frowned upon and you'd sold out. Yet the Clash had their biggest hit was Should I Sell, Should I Go to a Levi's advert that was re-released. I mean, that's double selling out, isn't it? Not only have you put your record on an advert, you've then re-released a record you already put out once for a bigger hit and then it works. So, no, I my sort of Levi's adverts memories are things like there was a brilliant... one that was called, I think it was called Twisted. It was to do with Levi's you could buy that had twisted seams around terribly cool at the time. I did have a pair and I have to say they looked good, but they were really uncomfortable, inevitably. And it was a
lot of chafing, I would think.
Yes, very much. And there was a tune called Before You Leave by Pepe Deluxe that twisted and turned a lot. And that, you know, they managed to find a way of matching everything perfectly. I think the most famous one, or the one that a lot of people will remember, perhaps the fact that it unleashed a Spaceman by Babylon Zoo onto the world. And having said that, I heard that record the other day and it sounded much better than you'd think. Also, the other thing that I did remember, and I think lots of people remember this, there was an advert, the title of the advert was Mermaids, and it featured a chap underwater in jeans, and some mermaids came along and took them off to Underwater Love by Smoke City, which I remember one particular summer really was the coolest tune. It was tremendous. So actually, in a way, Levi's had the advertising had a really big impression on me as a teenager in the 90s and the 2000s. So in a way, that for me was the kind of pinnacle of cool advertising that you do think, well, you know, if you must insist on flogging me stuff, you might as well do it in a clever way that's nice to look at with good tunes.
That was such a key change to the way we considered commercials.
I think it was,
and
yeah.
As you say, back in the 60s and 70s, it was considered that you were indeed, as you mentioned, selling out to the man if you either appeared in TV commercials or allowed your music to be in them. And I always remember there was something of a scandal in the early 80s when the music press, obviously before the internet and everything, music press revealed that David Bowie had appeared in commercials in Japan. And
For some sort of booze, sake, I think, or whiskey or something.
I think it was. And part of the deal was said to be a clear understanding that they would never be shown outside of Japan. And I was researching them this week, trying to look them up, and I saw there was a quote from David Bowie saying, "The money is a very useful thing," and you know, leaving us with no doubt of his motive in appearing in these ads. And it's quite strange because he carried on, even though he's the king of cool, David Bowie, isn't he? But he continued appearing in unlikely ads through the rest of his life. Vittel Water, Louis Vuitton, they were just a couple of his commercials overseas, but there's a real spread of them. But I think after the high spots of the Levi ads and the other well-thought-out campaigns like Guinness that you say, we're now going through another grim era, really. I watch a lot of sports.
The ITV4 adverts.
It's the huge number of commercials. The ones that I really can't bear, commercials promoting gambling with actors reassuring us that they bet responsibly. You know, I bet responsibly with gambling. Are us, you know.
Ray Winstone's disembodied head, everything that's wrong with society.
It's gruesome and dogged, I think. And they egg people on in the same manner. It's like a booze brand handing out free lager to alcoholics.
It's horrible. And my mum, who is never backwards in coming forward and her views on things, now sort of swears profusely at Barbara Windsor every time she appears on the TV because she appeared prominently in some bingo advertising. Mm.
Yeah, so when it's a similar thing. This preponderance currently, we're going through an absolute deluge of gambling at the moment. I don't know.
Although maybe that is because it is centred around a particular market. I don't know if you're like me, but I only ever tend to watch TV with advertising on it if I'm either watching my beloved Simpsons on Channel 4, which is always mobile phone ads, or watching football. And maybe we feel like we're watching a lot of gambling adverts because that's what we watch on commercial television. But I do agree that if you want to criticize people for taking the advertising shilling, you know, the filthy lucre, I do feel that the advertising gambling really is filth.
If I ever do watch the mainstream commercial television, it always seems to be your kind of Go Compares and Meerkats.
I was going to say those damn Meerkats.
They're just trying to do brand recognition and repetition, aren't they? It's no golden age, this, at all.
No, and it's interesting. And even if, I know we talked about sort of the golden age being perhaps Levi's and Guinness, but of course, you know, really, really famous people, really well, people that went on to be really well-known writers used to do advertising. I mean, Faye Weldon... did Go to Work on an Egg. And I think Salman Rushdie,
yeah.
What did he do? It was something really famous, wasn't it? I'm just trying to look it up now.
Was it British Rail? It was certainly a high-profile campaign that Rushdie did. While you look it up...
Cream Cakes,
so Naughty But Nice. That was Salman
Rushdie.
That
was him. Yeah. And you think so... You know, and of course, Mad Men, the programme is all about advertising, isn't it? And advertising agencies and you know, looks very cool and 60s American and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know, advertising's always been you're trying to make money, aren't you? So advertising has perhaps never been the noblest of buildings, businesses even rather. But I do feel that it is dreck at the moment. And of course, the most irritating advert of all. And actually irritating because it is trying to aim for the heights that we have said previously, yet has become impossibly formulaic, is this damn John Lewis advert.
Every Christmas.
That is the centerpiece. And the thing is that it is the thing that made Guinness and Levi's so good. The thing that made the Guinness and Levi's so good is it was a different idea each time. So Levi's found different ways of showing you jeans. So they showed you jeans in space. They showed you twisted jeans at a petrol station. They showed you jeans underwater. They showed you jeans in a laundrette. I know that, you know, they're all fairly prosaic things, but they were doing the same thing differently. Whereas you always know that the John Lewis advert is going to involve a drippy cover of an indie classic by a woman on an acoustic guitar that's half the speed of what it should be. And it's going to feature animals falling in love, or somebody buying somebody a present, or not buying somebody a present. And it's, I don't know, it annoys me because it's presenting itself as being like Guinness or Levi's, the pinnacle of advertising, and it isn't. It's formulaic and it's lazy and it's sentimental rubbish.
It's poor relation. Our legendary Premier League predictions are next.
Yes, strap in, people.
No one would gamble based on our powers of prophecy. It's going to be said.
Do the opposite. That usually seems to work for people.
That's next after this glorious track from Lauryn Hill.
No one's hurt me more than
I was going through some old CDs at home the other day, and I thought, do you know what album I haven't listened to for too long? The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. And it was like meeting an old friend again that I hadn't seen for ages. It was a huge album for me when I was a teenager. I quite liked the Fugees, but I just completely fell in love with this album. And I do think that this is one of the greatest breakup songs, or songs about a breakup, of all time. And when I tweeted about this earlier in the week, I then had a lovely hour where people proceeded to fill my replies feed with really miserable songs about people breaking up, most of which were superb, like It's Too Late and all that kind of stuff. But if this isn't the greatest breakup song ever, I do feel it states a fairly good claim. I think the lyrics are just really honest and really accurate. They don't over-egg it, but they don't kind of try and sugarcoat anything. And I just think it is incredibly moving and beautifully sung as well, I think. This is Lauryn Hill from The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, and this is X Factor.
She was only 22, 23 when she recorded that album.
It's masterful, isn't it?
It's really extraordinary. One of the great albums of all time. It was on an almost endless repeat play on my car's, well, it'd been a cassette player at the time, I suppose.
Ah, yes, of course.
Autumn of 88 and into 1999. And actually, I remember it so well because at the time I was working very hard. I was working simultaneously on two Bob Marley documentaries for TV that I was scripting.
And, of course, she married one of the Marley sons, didn't
that's
she?
That's the extraordinary thing. So
and then I think they split up, and that's what X Factor is about, I think.
Indeed. And so her album kind of kept me going and brought me inspiration because of that connection as well. There's a great Lauryn Hill. Jules, each year at this time, the world of football, it breathlessly awaits our mind-blowingly accurate predictions for the
Premier
League.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, yeah.
Indeed, I believe that BT Sports, Sky and BBC's Match of the Day, they all say that there's almost no point showing the football through the season, as our astonishingly precise predictions mean that the end result is nailed on by us before the season even starts.
Well, I've heard people say that before. Yeah,
me too. Well, perhaps more realistically, this is where we give our hapless guesses for the season ahead, and then we endure tweets from people saying, ha ha, didn't you say?
Yes. Can I point out as well that we do diversify into bad political predictions as well? Our general election predictions also, being, of course, entirely nailed on, yeah.
Yes, that was equally as hopeless. As is customary, Jules, we start with the gloomy side of the Premiership and the sides that will be relegated, along with and also I'll be asking you in a minute for the first managerial sacking of the season. But first of all, Jules, which sides will inhabit the last three places at the end of the season? And by the way, I'm writing these down.
Yes, you'll scratch your pen on your desk, yes. I have to say, I think they've done fantastically well in coming up. And I read a really interesting profile in The Observer a week or two ago, which was just fantastic about the town and the sense, the importance of football. They've got some very famous supporters, Patrick Stewart being one of them, apparently, but Sir Patrick Stewart. I wish that it wasn't, and hopefully I'll be completely wrong. So hopefully by cursing them here, I will uncurse them in real life. But I can't see Huddersfield staying up.
Right.
There's been a few managerial changes in the close season, and it'd be interesting.
Hard to keep up with.
Well, there's been three in the Premiership. So two at the end of last season, one in the close season. So Walter Mazzari left Watford. Sam Allardyce retired from Crystal Palace. And Claude Puel was sacked from Southampton. Now, I think all of these teams I'm tempted to pick at least one of these teams. I'm going to pick Watford.
Right.
Simply because I always feel that Watford are vulnerable. And I know that they do quite well despite themselves. But I have thought for a long time that the wheel is going to come off of Watford. So I would say them. And I suppose my third choice, it's hard to say, really. My head says Brighton, but my heart puts them at 17th because they are my local team and I don't want them to go down. I think probably my third choice. I find it really hard, actually. This is the hardest thing, I think. But actually, I am going to say Southampton.
Wow, okay.
Just because I'm not sure about their new manager.
Sure, that's fair
enough. They came eighth last season, but I think it could go wrong quite quickly there. I could be completely wrong. I probably will be. But
no,
I
can see your logic behind it. Who's going to be the first manager to be driving out of the training ground with a sad expression on his face, having been sacked?
I'm just trying to think. Well, Arsene seems to be unexpectedly safe at Arsenal, doesn't he? Despite all the kind of faffing about. I haven't necessarily picked them for relegation. My guess is going to be Paul Clement from Swansea.
Ah, right. OK, again, I can see the reasons for your choice there. I was very tempted to simply pick the three teams that got promoted.
That came
in
up. Yeah, yes, because that is
tempting. It seems such a jump now from the Championship to the Premiership. And indeed, as I'll explain, we nearly came very close. I should say, we don't know what each other's choices are before we speak now.
No, we don't.
I didn't know. So we came very, very close though to having the same three. In the end, I feel Newcastle might survive, as you obviously
yes,
do.
Yes, I do. I think they know too much.
Exactly. Otherwise,
and also, I think Rafa is fab. I love Rafa, and I think that Rafa does have the X factor, I think.
Now, otherwise, for me, it's who goes down, and I'm afraid, you know, sentiment. I don't want Brighton to go down, but I think they will. I think who goes down with Brighton and Huddersfield, and I think it will be between Bournemouth, Swansea, Burnley, and Watford. And like you, I'm picking Watford. Mm. I'm saying Huddersfield, Brighton, and Watford to go down.
And I think you're probably more. I think I got two of three last year. I think, but I think that you might beat me this year because I think probably those are the sensible choices.
And I can see your Paul Clement. First manager to go, I think Watford will probably stick with Marco Silva. I think they've got faith in. I think Huddersfield and Brighton have got boards that will be loyal to their managers.
Yes, they have. Brighton certainly have, and I think Huddersfield are similar.
Brighton have a terrific owner. So I think it's between. I think Crystal Palace may struggle, so I think Frank de Boer at Crystal Palace and Paul Clement at Swansea could be.
You see, it was Frank de Boer at Crystal Palace that put me off putting them in the bottom three, actually, because I think he might be good.
Well, I'm going against you there, and I'm going for Frank de Boer at Palace as the first manager of casualty.
Fair enough.
If they get off to a bad start.
Yeah.
And they're sort of third, fourth, bottom by November, December. These days, boards that don't have that inbuilt loyalty like the Brighton chap, they get twitchy, and I think he could go.
And Crystal Palace are twitchy, I think, and also their fans are very vociferous. So,
they are, yes.
Yeah. And I mean that fondly, because I have very dear friends of the Crystal Palace supporters, but yeah, they are very... It did make me laugh that I was reading the predictions of fans in the Observer, and I felt it said a lot, not perhaps necessarily good about the Brighton fan they got in, that they are so their highlight or their best thing of last season or their biggest hope, and it involved negative things happening to Crystal Palace rather than positive things happening to Brighton.
A new category for us this season: which team will definitely be joining the Premiership next time round? Which team will win the Championship, Jules?
This
is a tough one.
I would love to say my beloved QPR. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I think we might be... We got off to a winning start the other way. I thought we looked quite good. I think we might be in with a chance of perhaps winning, perhaps getting promotion. I'd love to see us get automatic promotion. I think we might make the playoffs, I think, realistically.
Okay.
I mean, it's almost difficult to predict the Championship because it is almost like a sort of I felt for a very long time that the QPR and other teams should be in the kind of the sort of league, the 0.5 league, I call it, that is between the Premiership and Division One. So
sure.
It's kind of, you know, sort of the shuttle league, really. So the people that need to go up and down all the time. I'm going to be a bit sort of bizarre here, some might say. And this is just a completely sort of almost a kind of loony sort of prediction, really. I'm going to say Aston Villa.
Okay.
And they've got John Terry there. They haven't changed manager recently. They've got Steve Bruce. I think that they might do it.
OK. Okay, it's almost like we have looked over each other's shoulders.
Oh,
when we've
really?
Yeah, I have, Villa. I just felt it's tough getting out of the Championship. Many are tipping Middlesbrough to jump back. Fulham, Wolves, Norwich are all contenders, but I can only pick. You know, I can only pick John Terry's Aston Villa. I think Aston Villa will conquer all and win the Championship. They've also brought in some other experienced players. They've got Steve Bruce, who's now had some time to bed in, and I really do think John Terry could make all the difference there in organising.
If not them, then I think that Jap Stam's Reading are also in with a shout.
Okay, I'll put them in brackets, but we're both agreeing on Aston Villa. Yeah. What about that? This is one of our more regular picks. Which team in the Premiership will be the surprise package and exceed all expectations?
Who's going to do a Leicester? I'd love to say Brighton, but that probably isn't true. Brighton probably need to do what Leicester did and survive for a season and then give it a go, I think. I have to say, this is the hardest season to predict,
yeah,
I think.
Agree,
and the
yeah.
reason why it is so hard is that the telly money has really bitten in now, which is why the Premier League, there is such a disparity and there is so much on getting yourself into the Premier League and staying there, I think. And the redistribution of the telly money, fairly, I think, has meant that everyone can buy. So it's not like the olden days where you had a definite top six. I think my surprise package will be West Brom.
Oh, okay. Tony Pulis, isn't it, at West Brom?
I think that, you know, Tony Pulis is a very underrated, I think, as a manager. Mm. Yes, his teams are not the prettiest, but they are very effective. And they finished 10th last season, and I just think they could do it. I think that they might, if they got on a run, I'm not sure how they'd be stopped.
I can see the logic behind it. My team to surprise us, and this is sort of figurative, so I need to explain what I mean, it's Everton, which you may think, well, you know, they're quite a top side already. But what I think, they have a strong squad now, despite the departure of Lukaku. And if any of the really top sides falter, I'm picking Everton to make it into the top four. They're not one of my top four picks, but I'm saying, you know, they'd be maybe fifth. And as I say, if they get on a run, they could very easily even challenge for the top. So
I think that's a sensible prediction.
I'm going Everton for my surprise package. Now, finally, Jules, in this section, which teams will be fighting for the ultimate crown? Your teams in order, please, to finish in the top four places in the Premier League.
Right, I'm going to go in reverse order.
So what's coming first? Fourth?
Think team four will be Liverpool.
Okay, so Jurgen Klopp to revolutionise Liverpool. They finished, you know, outside the top four last season, but you're putting them in the top.
I think they'll just make it in.
Okay.
So I think Liverpool will finish fourth. I think the third place team will be Manchester United.
Third Man United, okay.
Because and I think that a lot of that will depend upon how Lukaku performs. And I think if he gets firing, I think that they could perform better than that. But I think that realistically, they're probably likely to finish third.
Okay. So Liverpool fourth, Man United third. Second place?
I think that... I think Arsenal.
Arsenal?
Maybe Arsenal will always disappoint, but I just feel that Arsene might go on a bit of a run.
Okay. And I can't even think who you're going to pick for number one. Oh, sorry, you're going to say a bit more about Arsenal.
Well, no, what I was going to say was, I'm going to say now the teams that I haven't picked to win and why I haven't put them in the top four. I think Manchester City are going to underperform.
Right.
I think they've got their. I think they're starting to struggle a bit, and I think that Pep Guardiola's just as the joke that what Arsene always needs is another number 10. Guardiola always seems to pick another striker as the solution, and I think the defence is starting to get a bit ropey. They're very reliant on Kompany, who is often injured, and I don't know. I can't see Manchester City also, and I know this will upset our friend Joe very much, but I think the honeymoon might be over at Tottenham. And I am sorry, Joe. So my winning team is Chelsea, because I can't see past them.
Wow. Okay, well, finally here we've got absolutely massive differences here in our picks. Yeah,
how interesting. Okay.
Well, having watched the preseason friendlies and the Community Shield match last week,
so you're better briefed on this.
I'm really
more accurate.
I'm really worried about Chelsea. I don't think we'll win it again this season. Yeah, I think we're looking very, very shaky. Arsenal and Liverpool, to me, still looks like sides in decline. They're not bouncing back yet. But it is, though, I must say. I'm going to give a caveat here for both of us, really. It's another season that almost anything might happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
But here we go. Fourth place, Manchester United. I just think, surely with that squad, a great goalkeeper, they need more creativity. Yeah. That's what's going to stop them, I think, getting into the top spot. But I'm going to have Man United fourth. I'm going to put Chelsea down at third. Our new striker, Alvaro Morata, he looks terrified. It looks to me already like another sort of Torres or Shevchenko kind of situation.
Yes. I felt for Shevchenko. I really did, actually.
And I'm only saying now that Chelsea are in third because I'm hoping that by the end of the transfer window, we'll have picked up one or two more players, maybe even another striker. Second place, I'm going to go completely against what you said. The bridesmaids again, Tottenham. I think they still look a threat, but I do have huge doubts. I think the move to Wembley for their home games while White Hart Lane continues to be redeveloped, that could be a massive negative, and they must fear any injury or loss of form by Harry Kane because they've got no plan B.
Yeah, and that's where, although they do still have Ali, of course, but Tottenham, I think it's hilarious in a way, in quite a dark way, that, you know, Tottenham kept losing finals, didn't they, at Wembley, and everyone said, is there a curse of Wembley? Now they're playing their home games there. I don't think anybody thought that through.
It's mainly, I've got them in second place, not because I think so highly of them, although I do like watching Tottenham, and I like their manager.
I mean, I'm very pro, like, and they've got a lot of English players, and I like that.
Exactly, but I just think it's that the others are less convincing, rather than Tottenham proving their merit. But for my top place, I'm going completely against everything you've said, because I've gone for Manchester City. I think they've still got a strong squad. They've beefed up the fullbacks over the summer, and they've got still two world-class strikers in Gabriel Jesus and Aguero, Sergio Aguero.
Aguero is one of the best ever players in the Premier League, for my money. I think he's outstanding.
So I'm saying Man City to win it, but I do say I'm emphasising the caveat for both of us in that I think this is almost impossible to pick, because rather like Chelsea last year, you know, they just got on that massive run after losing at Arsenal terribly in the early autumn. Then we want this massive run, and I think if some team just manages to do that, and a manager manages to inspire or finds a formation that suits a particular team, anybody probably in the top eight sides from last year could probably make that run and win it. So we shall see, but we should put those aside. We generally have a look back at them around the Christmas period and put our heads in our hands and think, why did we say that? We'll see those come back and haunt us. Let your life lightly dance on the edges of time like dew on the tip of a leaf.
That is beautiful, man.
That was the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore. Time and what age has done to our contemporaries. That's next after King L.
Then they pulled nearly half of it down. So why the hell should I
Yeah, the wonderful voice and writing skills of Gary Clark, known to many from his time in the group Danny Wilson and their worldwide hit Mary's Prayer. And that was from a later project by Gary Clark in the mid-90s. King L from their album A Great Day for Gravity and the excellent track First Man on the Sun. Now, time, as Boy George so memorably once put it, is like a clock in my heart. And
I've often thought of you and Boy George in the same sentence.
Yeah, peace from a pod. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I remember people.
Are we going to get into this at any point?
We are now.
That's constant song lyrics.
That's the end of my lyrics. I remember people. I considered to be ancient, warning me that time speeds up the older you get. And I found that to be remarkably true. I remember my then girlfriend helping me through my despair when I first felt old. She took me out for a drink to the George Pub in Raysbury. I remember it well. I felt ancient. It was my birthday. I was 25.
Oh, you might as well have been dead, Terrence, really.
25. Working for Radio 4, presenting a weekly show on local radio. I was fit as a fiddle, my whole life ahead of me, and I felt old. Ludicrous.
Oh, dear. That's what they would call nowadays a quarter-life crisis.
Then with increasing rapidity, of course, the years and suddenly decades hurtle past. Then I was 50, I blinked and I was 60, and now I'm 62, and each day just zooms past. But Jules, you measure time by noticing the ages of your contemporaries and kind of how they're faring.
Yes, in a completely self-flagellating type way. I just look at very famous people that are my age and get depressed about how I've done nothing with my life, basically. So you know, I do think, oh, you know, I've done quite well, maybe. You know, I own my own flat, which I'm pleased about. Yeah. And, you know, I'm a lawyer, which is quite good. I have a job I quite like. I've got friends. Both my parents are alive and well, and I see them regularly. Isn't that good? I've got some great friends. I'm winning at life.
You are.
And then I note that Katy Perry is 32 years old and, you know, world famous star. I'd note that your actress Scarlett Johansson is 32 years old. I note that Calvin Harris is 33. For goodness sake, Ollie Murs is my age, apparently. And some guy, some no-mark called Mark Zuckerberg is also my age, apparently. Oh, so I do often sit and think, what have I done with my life? You know, Lily Allen is younger than me. Keira Knightley is younger than me. But the only way in which I manage to comfort myself, and this is incredibly bitchy, and it's about someone that I actually like very much, but Florence Welch of Florence and Her Machine fame. Well, she's 2 years younger than me, apparently.
Ah, okay.
And when you look at her on the television, as my mum said to me once when I was 26 and she was on the Brits, and mum went, how old is this Florence? And I went, she's 24. She's 2 years younger than me. And my mum said, if that woman is 24, then I'm Home Secretary. So look out, Amber Rose, because my mum is coming for your job. But so I don't know. It's funny, isn't it? That there are, it's very difficult to age people sometimes. And my sort of friendship group that I spend a lot of time hanging about at the moment, I am the youngest of that group by some way, and so I'm always kind of, I have a friend that periodically forgets my age and then gawps when it comes up in conversation. But it's odd, isn't it? Maybe I shouldn't be beating myself up about my contemporaries. Maybe I should be, you know, remembering that certain people have only achieved things, you know, only written things when they're a certain age. I think Einstein was a fairly late life achiever. I'm not sure.
Time and age play tricks with me, because I've always held sports people in high regard. My psyche tends to place them as older than me because I kind of look up to them.
And oh, I so see, yeah.
In my mind, Gary Cahill, John Terry, Alistair Cook, Frankie Dettori, in my mind, they're all older than me, even though in most of those cases, they're 30 years younger. But some people, I found it more back to your point. I was just thinking when you were saying about these people of your age, some people of my sort of era have always been old. And Nigel Farage is 9 years younger than me.
Well, Nigel Farage is younger than three of the Stone Roses.
Well, there you go. I mean,
John Squire, Manny and Ian Brown. I think he's younger than all three of them, I think.
And yet you would think he's a generation older than all of us, wouldn't you?
You put him at, well, maybe it's his views, his regressive views. And this is where I find people like him and Jacob Rees-Mogg, for example, who's only 48. I find them to be, and any kind of young Tories generally, and perhaps you could say this about other political party members, but it's particularly true of people on the right, the centre-right.
It does tend to be. It's the tweed, isn't it?
Yes, it's the sort of fogyishness. Mm. And maybe it's the fact that so much of that political view, particularly in the case of some of the Leavers, is based upon a Britain. They think a Britain of the past, the good old days. I don't think that time ever existed. I think they're harking back to a time that was never there, really. Janet Finch, the sociologist, talking about the myth of the golden age. There was no golden age. People died of cholera, you know. It wasn't more free, you know. People died needlessly down mines and whatnot. So yeah, maybe one's views have to be sort of forward thinking, whereas Helen Mirren, who is of some age, I believe she's in her 70s, is still, I think, fabulously attractive because she is young at heart and does not care at all. Eileen Atkins, another sort of contemporary of Helen Mirren, told a story that Colin Farrell, the young handsome Irish actor, kept repeatedly hitting on her, apparently. So maybe, you know, maybe it's about your state of mind rather than your actual age.
Well, the really peculiar thing is that we look out at the world with the same eyes that we had as a teenager and maybe even feel the same way inside. But it's the way people people look back at us that changes all the time. I'm probably only a few short years away now from being offered a seat on a train, you know, by a teenager.
Yeah, you have my seat if we were travelling together.
And the worst of it is I'm not far away from gratefully taking it.
I was going to say, you'd be pleased, I think.
It's terribly hard not to marry the passing of decades with being miserable about anything new. And I really have firmly decided recently, I've really taken this on board to really try and stop being snarky about things. I tell you, a good example is you young people and your radio heads. And the like of them. As I suddenly realised, very recently, it was just like old people making embarrassing comments about the Beatles or Todd Rundgren or the Clash to me, and I realised that I was turning into that kind of horror, you know, that sort of Nigel Farage of music criticism.
Why is there no tune? Yes, absolutely. Exactly. Isn't it funny? And I remember, again, you talk about kind of bands being your people being your contemporaries. So I watched the sequel to the Live Aid concert, Live 8. I watched it with my dad in 2005. I remember working for most of the day and not being able to see most of it, but I watched the evening bits with my dad. We were both rather unimpressed by the clowning of Robbie Williams, and we did very much enjoy Pink Floyd. And my dad, for as long as I can remember, has been an enormous Pink Floyd fan. I mean, I grew up listening to Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here, and I have my parents' copy of Metal proudly in my record box. And everyone's cheery sing-along number, One of These Days, I'm going to cut you into little pieces. But my dad's always been a big fan of Pink Floyd, and we were watching them, and my dad turned to me and said, "These are just old men now." And I said, "Dad, they've always been old." And he said, "No, they haven't," and was quite affronted, because of course my earliest memories of Pink Floyd were, I had a Division Bell postcard of the artwork on my book at school in the mid-90s, not long after it came out. I thought it was great, and still do. And so to me, they'd always been old, because they were just old, you know, they were just old men. They had graying hair. Whereas to my dad, you know, he always kind of, you know, they were his contemporaries. They're probably, my dad's 77. They're probably, some of them are probably similar-ish to my dad in kind of age. And I remember talking to someone I know about this a few months ago, and explaining to her that Pink Floyd were once young, and she's a few years older than me, but not many. And I remember us laughing, and I found the picture and sent it on Twitter, and I might try and post it on Twitter later on. And I just said, you know, the way they were, all the hair, look. And, you know, this idea that Pink Floyd once, you know, Dave Gilmore had long hair.
Oh, he was quite the pinner,
wasn't he?
He was quite
the thinking girls kind of, you know, a singer person. And I just know him as this guy with white hair whose adopted stepson swung off the cenograph, you know. It's you know, I can't quite believe that, you know, they were once these people. So it just goes to show, doesn't it, how your contemporaries, how, you know, it's my, and the fact was is that I didn't point out to my dad, but I think he sort of knew by him saying, "Oh, well, they're old men now, Pink Floyd." It was very hard not to say, "Well, in which case, by association, so are you, aren't you?" Because they're your age, you know, you are the old guys now.
Now, on the theme of aging, it's not quite yet your birthday week.
No, that's that large commemorative event is coming up in a few weeks' time.
It is, but no doubt you are out and about all across that south coast this coming week.
Yes, I am. I'm trying to remember what on earth it is I'm meant to be doing this weekend. So I don't think I have any live engagements this weekend. None that I've remembered, anyway.
That's disappointing.
Yes, it is. It's no Saturday Social this week. That's back next week, I think. Okay. In the meantime, I will be doing Indie Wonderland next Wednesday on Barricade Radio. So that's we've now fixed our website, thank goodness. So it's indie, alt rock, and miscellaneous from 8 until 10 p.m. www.barricaderadio.com. I'm also doing some charity run for St Michael's Hospice in Alexandra Park in Hastings. It's a 5-kilometre race on Sunday. I don't know who's sorting sponsorship. I might yet be tweeting about that. Okay. But in the meantime, I'll be doing 5 kilometres around the park I grew up in, whilst people throw paint at me and I have a pink painted face. So do look forward to seeing pictures of my distress on social media.
Huge thanks to our ageless executive producer, Rona.
Yeah, age will not wither her, indeed. We did a fair play to Rona and all who wish to sail in her.
And to play us out, a song from the Beatles' White Album.
Indeed, yes, and an uncharacteristic song from the Beatles' White Album. That, you know, there's some real dark masterpieces on that record, and an awful lot of filler, it has to be said. Yes. Me and my friend occasionally talk about doing our White Album project, which is make one White Album, make a single CD out of the White Album. We will try and do this again soon, I'm sure. But I love this because it's a short song. I always dislike John Lennon's attitude towards Paul's granny songs. I think Paul McCartney's a wonderful pop writer. I just think that, you know, he's not afraid to be beautiful, and I think that is a really wonderful quality. And I love this because it's quite short. It gets a bit lost in the kind of the sonic experimentation of the White Album. It's not exactly Revolution 9, although find me someone that sat through Revolution 9 more than once not in an unaltered state, and I'll find you a pig that flies. But I really like this. I think it's just such a beautifully written song. I've always tried to learn how to play it on the guitar, and it sounds so simple, and this is the art of the Beatles, I think, and Paul McCartney particularly. It sounds so simple and so easy, and it flows so beautifully, and it is so hard to play on the guitar, but it is a wonderful little song, and it's unfairly overlooked, I think. So hopefully we can all enjoy this now. These are the Beatles, and this is I Will.
Who knows how long I've loved you? You know I love you still. Will I wait a lonely lifetime? If you want me to, I will. For if I ever saw you, I didn't catch your name, but it never really mattered. I will always feel the same. Love you forever and forever. Love you with all my heart. Love you whenever we're together. Love you when we're apart. And when at last I find you, your song will fill the air. Sing it loud so I can hear you. Make it easy to be near you. For the things you do endear you to me. Oh, you know I will.
You have been listening to a DAKAM Media production.